Today, free money or not? The DFA Daily to the 5th of April 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The Australian Bankers Association today released a statement saying that the Australian banks are ready to support the JobKeeper programme to help as many Australian businesses and their employees as possible access the benefits while they wait for the scheme to make the first payments. They said businesses may be able to use the upcoming JobKeeper payment program as a basis to seek credit in order to pay their employees until the scheme is making its first payments. And the Australian Banking Association's CEO Anna Bligh said banks are working hard to make the JobKeeper scheme a success and to ensure that millions of Australians remain in jobs. Banks stand shoulder to shoulder with the Australian government and businesses across the country to help us emerge on the other side of the crisis, strong and ready to rebuild, Ms. Bligh said. As many businesses face a number of weeks of little or no cash flow before they receive payments under the government's JobKeeper program, Australian banks may be able to help. Many businesses may be eligible for credit, for example, an extension to their overdraft, which can offer them cash flow to pay their staff while they wait for the JobKeeper program to make the first payments. Each business will be assessed on a case-by-case basis to determine the assistance that may be appropriate to their circumstances. Businesses affected by the current health crisis should contact their bank to access these initiatives and discuss what support is available to them, including options to defer loan repayments for up to 6 months. So the solution to the current emergency is more credit. And we wonder what the interest rate will be and when repayments will be triggered. This is not straightforward. And let me give you an example from the UK, where government-backed loans to businesses were offered as a last resort. The banks there have been found to be asking very high rates of interest for potential loans. The UK scheme is explained as providing facilities of up to £5 million for smaller businesses across the UK who are experiencing loss or deferred revenues, leading to disruptions in their cash flow. It supports a wide range of business finance products, including term loans, overdrafts, invoice finance, and asset finance, and provides the lender with a government-backed guarantee, enabling a no-credit decision from a lender to become a yes. And note that the borrower always remains 100% liable for the debt. One issue which is causing consternation is that despite the partial guarantee of 80% against outstanding balances, guarantees are likely to be required from company directors for the remaining 20%. So this means that individuals are obliged to provide guarantees and jeopardise their personal solvency to save their companies, even ones with limited liability. And there seems to be a 60% portfolio cap on loans, which may discourage banks from lending. So the question is, will a loan solve the problems of a company that's on the brink? It risks pushing the problem down the road. And in fact, just as in the financial crisis and the Great Recession, the highly financialized nature of the UK economy means that financial institutions, including banks and other liquidity firms, see the government's response to the crisis as a way of profiting from government-backed insurance, in this case, taxpayer-guaranteed Bank of England loans issued at record low interest rates. Beneath the smoke and mirrors of the government's approach lies old-school profiteering, little different, frankly, from predatory payday loan companies. And we hear that now Chancellor Rishi Sunak is poised to overhaul the government's £330 billion support scheme for small businesses, following a backlash of how the scheme was being run. The Treasury promised to guarantee £330 billion worth of loans to small businesses to help them weather the current storm. Businesses could apply for loans of up to £5 million, which are interest-free for 12 months. The government promised to cover any losses on the loans made by banks, up to 80% of the loan value. The scheme was part of an unprecedented package of support for small businesses and was worth around 15% of UK GDP. However, the programme has met with almost constant criticism since its launch. Around 40 financial institutions are doling out support loans on behalf of the government, but businesses say that the banks are being too slow and in some cases profiteering. Banks were criticised for asking for personal guarantees from business owners on loans above £250,000. The guarantees meant to cover losses on the 20% of the loan not banked by the government, meaning that entrepreneurs could lose savings and investments if their firm went bust and they could not pay back the entire loan. Some lenders are also said to be charging interest rate hundreds of times higher than the Bank of England's 0.1% base rate. Labour MP Chris Bryant said last week that he was aware of banks charging interest rates between 7% and 12%. And business owners are frustrated with the speed at which banks are moving, with loan applications taking too long and money being offered in 45 days in some cases. Richard Burge, chief executive of London Chamber of Commerce and Industry, said on Thursday that the government money simply isn't flowing fast enough down the chain. Sunak is planning to remove the requirements for banks to assess applicants for standard loans before looking at the government scheme. The idea is that this should speed up the process. And the Chancellor is also said to be in talks to get the banks to agree to a limit the interest rate charge on those loans after the 12-month interest-free period expires. And also from the UK, Fitch Ratings has taken actions on 7 mid-sized UK banking groups to reflect the downside risks in their credit profiles, resulting from the economic and financial market implications of the health crisis. The actions include Investec Banking, Tesco Personal Finance, Virgin Money, Close Brother Groups and Metro Bank PLC, the Cooperative Bank and Paragon's long-term IDR affirmed, negative outlook. Fitch expects global economic growth to decline sharply in 2020 and now estimates that the UK's GDP could fall by close to 4% in 2020 in its baseline forecast, followed by a sharp recovery in 2021. This expectation is based on the assumption that containment measures will be unwound in the second half of 2020, with material downside risks to those forecasts, they said. And the UK authorities have taken monetary and fiscal support measures for the private sector, which should be positive for the banking sector. Nevertheless, they expect the bank's asset quality to weaken compared to previous expectations and earnings to come under pressure from lower business volumes, higher loan impairment charges, and pressure on net interest margins. And this is what they said about Metro Bank, one of the problem children in UK banking. Fitch has downgraded Metro Bank's long-term IDR and VR by one notch to BB- and BB- respectively, and assigned a negative outlook on the IDR. The rating action reflects heightened challenges in its business model, earnings, and ability to deliver its strategy, which are further compounded by the economic fallout from the health issues. The health disruptions make execution on Metro Bank's strategy more difficult in the near term because of weaker prospects for growth, lower interest rates, and slower demand for loans. The bank has undergone significant organizational changes, and its earnings were expected to be depressed by restructuring charges and a slowdown in lending. But the health issues also poses an operational challenge for Metro Bank, given its small size, staff capacity, and management turnover. Metro Bank's earnings were very weak at £53 million operating loss in 2019, excluding impairment of tangible and intangible assets. Fitch expects that a return to profitability will be made more difficult by the health crisis. Lower lending volumes, interest rates and transaction fees and larger credit losses from small amounts will weigh on the 2020 loss. To a certain extent, this could be compensated by lower funding costs if debt issuance is delayed in the light of lower counter-cyclical buffer requirements, or if planned investments are delayed And over the longer term, the bank needs scale and better cost efficiency to break even. And the extent and speed at which they can be achieved will depend on the length and depth of the crisis, as well as the quality of execution on a range of measures management has committed to. Asset quality is a rating strength, and loans are performing and dominated by mortgage lending. Credit risk exposure to more vulnerable sectors is mainly in Metro Bank's commercial loans portfolio, which represents less than a third of the loan book. This is skewed towards commercial real estate. And capital ratios were high at 15.6% CET1 ratio at the end of 2019, but will likely be eroded by the year's net loss. Minimum requirements for its funds and eligible liabilities, the MREL, of 20.5% for 2020 against the 22.1% position at the end of 2019, leaves limited buffers for capital erosion before breaching requirements. And Metro Bank entered the crisis with high liquidity and a moderate 101% loan-to-deposit ratio. The disruptions will be a test of Metro Bank's deposit resilience and may impede plans to grow deposits, although they understand from management that today retail deposits have been relatively stable. Positively, the bank will be able to access the Bank of England's term funding scheme, the TFS, with additional incentives for SMEs to refinance part of their existing TFS drawdown. So you can see the pressure on the banks whilst there is cheap funding from the Bank of England, very cheap funding. There is still a question of commercial execution of its loan portfolio and the ability to be able to write loans effectively through the cycle. And I think that in microcosm highlights the risks and issues not just in banks in the UK, but also banks here in Australia. Sure, there is cheap funding, but the question is, will they be able to manage their loan portfolios effectively, deal with delayed loan repayments, and also deal with the issues relating to extended losses? And over in the US, the Wall Street Journal reported that, reflecting turmoil in the mortgage market, Wells Fargo will only refinance jumbo mortgages with clients who hold at least $250,000 in liquid assets at the bank. In other words, a customer who already has a jumbo loan with Wells Fargo can't refinance to take advantage of lower rates unless they keep their funds at the bank. Its policies for loans that are used to buy properties haven't changed, but jumbo loans are considered too large to be sold to government-sponsored enterprises such as Fannie or Freddie. This means more than $510,400 in most markets, but that can run to larger amounts, up to $756,600 in more pricey markets. And Wells Fargo is the largest lender for jumbo loans, extending some $70 billion worth of them last year. Conventional loans guaranteed by Fannie or Freddie are still widely available, but loans without government backing have become harder to get as market volatility makes investors warier about buying such big loans. Unlike some banks that tend to keep jumbo loans on their balance sheets rather than sell them, Wells Fargo is limited by how much it can keep on its balance sheet. Since 2018, the Fed imposed a cap on Wells Fargo's total assets in the wake of the fake account scandal that was disclosed in 2016. And earlier this week, the company said it would stop purchasing all jumbo loans made by third-party mortgage bankers. And finally, it's worth noting that looking at the S&P 500 index, no sooner did the new quarter get underway on the first trading day in April, and the five-day respite that some were declaring a new bull market, it was not, regardless of whether the bounce happened to sneak above the 20% line, it all quickly ended with a thud. But in reality, the fate of the rally was already largely decided last Thursday, when the bounce peaked at 2,637 and suddenly ran out of smoke. The S&P 500 index has been rolling back over ever since. And this is quite simple to explain. Stock prices are normally reflective of expected future earnings. And at the moment, literally no one knows what these will be. Sure, the volatility will continue, but until such time as the health issues are contained, perhaps a minimum of 6 months, the market will not be able to anchor a realistic price. It is literally a casino at the moment. Gamble if you like, but there are no value anchors. And this is why the volatility index, the VIX, the fear index as they call it, remains elevated. On Friday, March the 20th, when the VIX finally broke its staggering great financial crisis reminiscent uptrend, many were calling the bottom. But instead of descending back lower, the VIX has remained stubbornly elevated. Yes, it's currently reading 57.06, and that's a little bit better than its March peak of 85.47. But we should not forget that we've had a sustainable reading over 50, and that's happened only once before in the past three decades. Thus, the fact that we are still lingering at these historically high levels suggests, if anything, that US stock markets may be reloading for another sharp move to the downside in the coming days. So there's no V-shaped recovery here. And it's worth reflecting that now the Fed and Congress have thrown a couple of kitchen sinks at the problem, the main lever will now be lockdowns. But this will be a long, slow road. And until the US economy fires again, other economies will continue to languish too. And finally, before I go, just to let you know that we're running a special live Q&A event on Tuesday the 7th of April at 8 p.m. Sydney time. You can join the chat live to ask a question or send one in via the DFA blog ahead of time. And also this week, I've arranged to record further shows with Harry Dent, he of the Big Four claim, Chris Bates, a mortgage broker and financial advisor, and also somebody deep in the crypto space to discuss the recent market dynamics there. In each case, if you have specific questions for them, send them through to me via the blog as soon as you like. I want to continue, however, to look beyond the immediate crisis to think about what solutions may lay beyond. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.